I think she put it so beautifully. It's impossible to sustain a movement on the basis of stereotyping the enemy so that you can spit in his face. This is what we do inevitably in a war.
Well, the enemy can't be found in the urban society. This is the difficulty for the Negro.
Is it not the establishment, though?
Well, but who's the establishment? Who's the power structure? You're constantly asking this question. When you tackle schools here, you may decide that there is a different power over here with housing, that they may or may not be related. I've heard this question raised so often as to where is the power structure? Is it the business community? And you go fighting phantoms.
No, it seemed to me you began to identify it earlier, Bertice, when you talked to organizing for political power. I think this is where we begin, and we ought not to minimize the statement you made earlier. The change in the South comes not through an attack on the Board of Education, per se, and efforts to integrate the schools, so much as it comes out of registering Negroes to vote. The politician who wants to continue in office now has another audience to talk to, and
Negroes vote in Chicago.
Negroes vote in Chicago, perhaps not in enough numbers, and perhaps have been for too long tied to what they thought was the instrument for help politically in Chicago. And as you well know, Bertice, better than I, who now am an expatriate, there is a political movement within the Negro community to change leadership, if this can at all be achieved. And
to change or to force more from those who are in power.
Whichever it may be. Now, I'm reminded, I moved to Chicago in 1952, shortly after the state legislature had enacted a piece of legislation which made it impossible for the Chicago Housing Authority to acquire land without the prior consent of the city council.
That meant of the aldermen in
the
individual
aldermen
neighborhoods.
In the individual neighborhoods. Each alderman then began to exercise what was, in a sense, a veto power.
That's right.
In the council. And as a result, we have this monstrous 4.5-mile high-rise ghetto built as public housing.
The crime on State Street.
Mm-hmm. Call it what you will, but this was a politically developed and a politically sustained affair. And it seems to me that, again, this is where we begin. Power for the powerless comes in registering them as voters and comes out of a sustained program of education as to where their interests lie. The labor union long since has said this: we'll reward our friends and punish our enemies.
I think that I'd like to just comment in relation to that. The ghettoization of people, the confining of people of certain groups into certain areas. I think that one of Jane Addams' major guiding principles as she moved into the city and as she attempted to minister to the needs of people who had newly arrived in the city was her belief that the strength of the neighborhood lay in maintaining its cultural and ethnic diversity, that the very bringing together of different people with different backgrounds, with different Weltanschauung, if you will, with different ways of looking at the world, was really the basis for her philosophy.
I'm glad you said that, Alan.
And now, of course, we have in the crime on State Street and Robert Taylor Holmes' politically determined decision to keep
which,
Negroes...
Which, by the way, is the largest public housing project in the world.
30,000 people living there.
But you see,
20,000 children.
But I think Jane
Negro.
Addams would be for open occupancy today.
Yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. Neighborhood
exactly
today is a distortion of neighborhood as Jane Addams saw it, where it would be a model of world peace. If people could live together, different ethnic groups in a small unit could demonstrate that they could enrich each other's lives by what they brought. But today, you see, neighborhood is where the Negroes are, somewhere else, out in left center.
You know, there are two points that came up, well, many, but two very, very pertinent points. One was that musical comedy that occurred. It was, in a sense, Ned Goldberg refers to when the aldermen at the time discussing the building of public projects, knowing it would be primarily Negro, wanted it, but in the other guy's ward.
Mm-hmm. No, but what happens out of this circumstance is that Caucasians in Chicago with low income are not served by the Public Housing Authority. And there are large numbers of Caucasians in this community with inadequate community, and not just Appalachians. Yeah. There are men who, for many, many years, earned their livelihood in the stockyards, and when the slaughtering pens moved out of Chicago, were left behind. And these were not necessarily Negro. These were men, some of them automated out of jobs, and some of them whose factories moved away and left them behind. And what happens out of this kind of a complex is that the Negro has a ghetto, but much more decent physical facilities in that ghetto than has the Caucasian.
Than some of the Caucasians.
Than a large number.
I don't know.
No, Ned is making Ned is generalizing a little bit. He's making a very important point, and I want to relate this to Jane Addams. I don't think that that she would have addressed herself primarily in the relief of poverty, for example, to the needs of the Negroes. If there had been Negroes in large numbers here, then she would have been concerned, as you said, Bertice, for the working together to create a better neighborhood and a better city, and therefore a better world on the part of different and diverse groups. Mm-hmm. And at the present time, one of the things we need to think about in Chicago is not just the needs of the poor Negro, but the needs of the white people at the lower end of the economic scale, because these are the ones that are the most adamant against the progress of the Negro, the most threatened by the upward mobility of the Negro. And until
this
some
like
of these
the poor white in the South.
I think that this is festering below the surface in this city, and of course it stands ready to break out at any moment, this extreme bitterness and anger and ugliness that exists in our neighborhoods, especially the low-income ones.
If you can promote a free society, you can destroy some of that, because if everyone has the freedom to move, no one is going to feel put upon in the way you describe, Alan.
Since this is the
theme. You see, they can move, too.
Right. But they can't now.
I mean,
the
but they
white,
would
the
they
lower
would have
income
the same,
whites can't either.
But they would be able,
economically.
Under such
that's
a program
right.
as a rent supplement
economically.
Program.
Whereas the Negro
example.
Can't, the poor Negro can't move economically plus color of skin.
Mm-hmm.
Plus
mm-hmm.
both, you see. Hey, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that one of the that number of people, I think, in thinking about the Jane Addams times and ours, say that the Negro is merely the latest or maybe the last in the ethnic groups, to minority groups to move into the central city, and that their problems are no different from the problems that were faced by the Lithuanians and the Poles and the Hungarians and the successive waves of people who were called Bohunks and Wops and Kikes and all the rest of it. This, of course, is true in a way, but it also
it's a fallacy.
The extremely important point of the lack of mobility of the Negro because of the color.
We would all
issue.
Subscribe to this.
That is the fallacy.
Yes.
It is complete, fallacy.
And the fallacy, well,
generations
yes.
of Negroes have to endure what one or two generations of
that's
foreign-born
right.
Went through
yes.
and escaped very quickly, but the high visibility of the Negro makes him.
You know, another point that comes up, you use this phrase, and I know this phrase that none of the three of you like, and I know it's a question of culturally deprived. Culture by whose culture? Suppose we touch upon that aspect, and Jane Addams thought about this too, since she was always made people proud of the richness of all these, mm-hmm. at the time, people from other countries, but the culturally deprived, the Negro, and culture, let's say.
Negroes whose have their own culture. What they've had to do at points was to sacrifice some of the things they held dear to try to be accepted by the white society. And white society seems to have made demands on Negroes to be like us, you see. And so what some people mean when they say culturally deprived may be quite different from what I mean. When I say culturally deprived, and I'm referring to certain Negroes, I'm referring to those who have not had the advantage of a decent education, which is not available for the poor anywhere, but certainly it's not available for poor Negroes. I am also concerned about Negroes who haven't even had the benefit of the ordinary services that cities give. When they can feel comfortable in a physical sense, they can take on some of the other enrichment programs that we describe.
Yeah.
But I don't see Negroes as culturally deprived. I don't call myself culturally deprived.
I
Negro.
Think maybe this phrase, it ought to mean the tremendous gap that exists between the majority of lower-income Negroes and the opportunity to achieve the major economic and material blessings of our society. This is a
but
different...
But see, then poor whites are culturally deprived,
right,
too.
That's exactly.
And there's no thought ever given to the fact of learning from the other.
That's right.
I mean, the assumption is that the dominant Anglo-Saxon Saxon culture is perfect. If you want to draw further, go further. Therefore, we're also perfect for other societies and other countries as well, and rice paddies, too.
No, but start, yeah.
But how many pure Anglo-Saxons do we have?
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens in this kind of controversy when it begins to be considered in a variety of other settings is that it gets defined somewhat this way. Shall we be dedicated to efforts in the context of lifestyle, or shall we concentrate our efforts in programs which are labeled as higher horizon programs? And this is a meaningful controversy only as it's debated around the table. As I watch people work, in the community with young people who have either dropped out or been pushed out of school, and I think it's as much of the latter, and if not more than the former, I find that regardless of which of these philosophies they subscribe to, lifestyle, you know, which is, means protect my culture, or higher horizons, attach yourself to the American dream, become upwardly mobile, and all of the rest of it, regardless of which they subscribe to, they behave in precisely the same way as they work with young people, as they work with parents, because they bring with them that which they are. And they are a different kind of role model, and they have made it, you know, or else they are on their way to making it, and young people and adults both accept them as the valid role model, and then we inevitably drift into this higher horizons kind of bit. Now, I have no objection to our all becoming middle class if we factor out of the middle class values those which are rooted in a decent set of values and ethics, and if we can discard the rest of it as the kind of dross that it is. I have no objection to everyone continuing to go to school for as long as he wants to continue to learn. I subscribe to continuing education. Now, this is a middle class concept. But be that as it may, this is what opens up opportunity for people.
That's right.
This is what stretches their imaginations and their minds and makes available to them entry into an opportunity system which we foreclose. So it may be middle class, but one of my missions is to help people latch onto this concept of continuing education, and I don't mean always informal institutions.
This was incidentally one of Jane Addams' major interests, the provision of Americanization classes and acculturation groups and art centers and employment bureaus and lunchrooms and day nursery centers and all the rest of it.
Search for beauty, wasn't it, really?
Yes.
Search for beauty.
Yes.
In the midst of
that
ugliness.
The possibilities.
That's right.
It was an effort also to provide some choices to people, some alternatives that they could see open to them. And I think so many of our people in the ghettos in the large cities today are denied this hope.
But basically, Jane believed in what democracy offered to all people as a promise.
That's right. Yeah.
And she said, let's bring this to fruition.
That's right.
Let's really achieve for all people an opportunity to find themselves, to respect themselves as individuals for their own innate human capacities, and create opportunities for them to really try out their muscle on this world in such a fashion as to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Out of this process, said she, comes people who will give leadership to the resolution of all of the social problems. See, she focused on people, yes, but out of a love for people and a hatred for institutions, and I think that needs to be said. She loved people and she hated institutions, and she wanted to remake the institutions, but not single-handed. She wanted to arouse in people all about her, the residents who came from the elites and the neighbors. She wanted to arouse in all of them a sense of what it was possible to achieve by working together in changing these miserable institutions, which perpetrate on all of the world the miseries of poverty, of hunger, of despair, and of war.
And to get back to your original question, while he's talking about institutions and education, she would be at home with Head Start, for example, a program which starts, a part of the anti-poverty program, which starts with a very young child, the preschool child, and tries to help that child catch up with his peers by the time he enters formal education in the schools through several enrichment programs.
Yes, I agree. Wouldn't just let me interrupt a second, Bertice, to ask if she wouldn't see the obscenity, though, involved in provision of a federally supported preschool program to prepare people to go into city-supported public schools, which are simply deprived in comparison with schools in the suburbs around this city. Our kids have to compete with those kids for available places in this world, and they're being gypped. There's no question about it.
Well, Alan, she would make more noise than most social workers are making today about the gap between the Head Start and what these children are going to face in the public schools.
Well, the settlements didn't invent the kindergarten, but we did import it from Germany early in the history of the settlements. And then we imported Montessori from Italy, too, in the settlements. Because, the Jane Addams and the others, the Graham Taylors and the Robert Woods, said they, these young people, living really at home in another culture, speaking most of them another language, need a bit of a head start, need some preparation for the public school. Mm-hmm. And so she engaged in this, but not to the exclusion of all of her other interests and concerns.
Yes,
she said,
if we're to engage
in prevention, the earlier we can start, the better. The younger the children into whose lives we intervene so that we can improve their life's chances, the better. But we can't